Some European countries want to ensure that there's judgment for alleged Russian war crimes related to its invasion of Ukraine, and they're setting up investigative units.
The interesting one is the Germans, because Germany has a principle of universal jurisdiction, that their court can take prosecution even if a crime is being committed outside Germany.
Plus, what's next after Poland's initial plan to route MiG-29s to Ukraine through a U.S. airbase was denied?
Not that the United States is opposed to Ukraine having additional aircraft. It's just the logistics of that proposal just are not going to work.
And later in the program, the effect the war has had on the international community. Today is Wednesday, March 9th. From the Voice of America, this is Flashpoint Ukraine. Good evening. I'm Steve Miller. Russia announced plans for new ceasefires Wednesday to allow civilians to leave several parts of Ukraine besieged by Russian forces. This is despite Ukrainian officials accusing Moscow of shelling another evacuation route in the southern part of the country. In other developments on Wednesday, the decommissioned Chernobyl nuclear power plant, the site of the world's worst nuclear catastrophe nearly 36 years ago, lost power after its grid source was damaged. That's according to Ukrainian Foreign Minister Dmytro Kuleba. The International Atomic Energy Agency is aware of that development and says that the power loss violates a key safety pillar, but it also added it sees no current critical impact on safety. The international community also continued to target Russia's economy. The European Union agreed on Wednesday to bolster its sanctions in response to Russia's invasion, including measures targeting senior Russian officials and oligarchs, as well as restrictions on the maritime sector and several Belarusian banks. Russia also made what the United States and Ukraine are calling false claims Wednesday. Moscow said the U.S. must explain a biological program in Ukraine. Russia's foreign ministry said the alleged U.S. program involved deadly pathogens, including the plague and anthrax. Washington dismissed the allegation as absurd misinformation, and a Ukrainian presidential spokesperson added that Kyiv strictly denies any such allegation. The AP's Sagar Magani has more developments from Wednesday.
Russian forces have achieved less and struggled more than anticipated in a country Putin has long maintained doesn't actually exist.
He's dead wrong about that. Real countries fight back.
And CIA chief Bill Byrne says Ukrainians have, heroically. Defense Intelligence Agency director Scott Barrier says Russia's lost a significant number of troops in just 2 weeks.
With low confidence, somewhere between 2,000 and 4,000.
But Byrne says while Putin appears frustrated, there are no signs he's backing down. His main goal remains replacing Kyiv's government with a puppet regime.
I fail to see how he can produce that kind of an endgame. And where that leads, I think, is for an ugly next few weeks in which he doubles down.
Sagar Magani, Washington.
Ukraina, с першого дня.
In a video address on Wednesday, Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky said that his government has been asking Western governments to close the skies since the first day of Russia's invasion. He added that not doing so would make the West partly responsible for any humanitarian catastrophe. So far, NATO and other Western countries have not agreed to implement a no-fly zone, and Poland's offer to send MiG-29 jets to an airbase in Germany so that they can then be passed on to Ukraine, was denied by the United States. In a video message also earlier this week, Zelensky highlighted the Russian shelling of fleeing civilians from a town on the outskirts of Kyiv. Germany and Britain are among European countries that are in the process of setting up war crime units to gather evidence to be used later for war crime prosecutions. From Warsaw, Poland, Jamie Detmer joins us with the details.
Well, if you recall, at the weekend, the Ukrainian president, Zelensky, was saying eventually there'll be Judgment Day, and many European nations are pushing to make sure that happens. There are several countries who've organized war crimes units, including Britain, Germany, Spain, and others. And we've got, last week, we had the International Criminal Court saying they're going to open an investigation. The Ukrainians have gone to the International Court of Justice, which is the UN's top court, asking for them to investigate alleged war crimes, crimes against humanity, crimes of aggression, and genocide. These will take some time, but they are clearly, all of these investigations will take considerable time, ICC in particular, but they are laying down a marker that bombing of civilian infrastructure, shelling of civilians as they're fleeing is just not acceptable, and they do mean to prosecute in the future. The interesting one is the Germans, because Germany has a principle of universal jurisdiction, that their courts can take prosecutions even if a crime is being committed outside Germany and does not involve any German people, either victims or the perpetrators. They've used that to prosecute members of the Islamic State terror group. They've used it to prosecute and successfully in January a Syrian colonel. They tend not to be hidebound by bureaucracy and procedure as much as the ICC. So this could be an inflection point in many ways in how we treat war crimes and that we do try to prosecute them.
Jamie, I wanted to switch gears just a little bit and focus specifically on NATO. We'll be hearing from VOA Pentagon correspondent Carla Babb in just a moment about the whole Polish aircraft that were going to be sent to an American airbase and then later transferred to Ukraine. That was nixed by the Biden administration. But I wanted to ask you about what NATO is doing to support Ukraine, because again, on Wednesday, Zelensky, the Ukrainian president, repeated his request for a no-fly zone.
I mean, on the MiG-29s, the Polish officials I'm here in Warsaw at the moment have been saying to me this has been slightly overstated by the international press, you know, the international media, who see it as a big fracture in NATO's common front. They're saying they were ready to deploy, that they kind of acknowledged there was a miscommunication with the Americans who had not approved this as of yet. And that they're saying there's not a big fracture there about these planes, because in the end, this was a decision that the whole of NATO had to take, and it wasn't just about America and Poland. On the no-fly zone, however, there are big divisions of opinion about it. And in a sense, the problems about the MiG-29s is rather reflective of that. There are some NATO members who are more bullish, like the Poles, and there are other NATO members, like the Italians, who are very, very concerned about this going into a wider European war. And their feeling is that if they try to impose a no-fly zone, this will be seen by the Russians as a direct military challenge. We've already had Putin warning that he will see it as a declaration of war, that there'll be a direct conflict between NATO forces and Russian forces, which is why they're very wary. They want to bolster their defenses, NATO defenses in Eastern and Central Europe, provide aid to the Ukrainians to defend themselves, but they are frightened of this broadening. Now, there are people who are breaking ranks about this. We've had a former NATO Supreme Commander, an American general, saying that he now believes a no-fly zone should be imposed. We have a former British general saying the same. We have got 27 foreign policy experts, some of whom are former White House officials and diplomats, urging President Biden to consider a no-fly zone. I spoke last week to a former UK representative to NATO who was around during the Balkans War. And one thing that he said to me was, you know, at the moment, I don't think NATO is going to change its position about the no-fly zone. But will they hold that position if there's more civilian infrastructure being destroyed, more civilians being killed? Remember the Balkans, in the sense that political and public pressure grew on NATO to intervene. You know, his point is that once you get a war, you can't always foresee the trajectories and what will happen.
Jamie Detmer is reporting for VOA from Warsaw, Poland. Jamie, thank you for your time.
Pleasure.
Now, as I mentioned earlier, Washington rejected Poland's unexpected offer of MiG-29 jets, with the Pentagon Press Secretary John Kirby saying the Pentagon did not believe that Poland's proposal was a tenable one. Speaking alongside British Foreign Secretary Liz Truss, U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken recounted that the two of them had just returned from Europe and meeting with other counterparts from the G7 and the EU, discussing their
extraordinarily close coordination and cooperation in response to Moscow's unprovoked, unjustified, and increasingly brutal war in Ukraine.
Now joining me to further discuss the U.S. response is VOA Pentagon correspondent Carla Babb.
That is right. They said that it was untenable. And as a senior defense official was explaining to reporters today, they just don't know how it would work the way that it was presented by the polls. Because what the polls wanted to do is the polls wanted to give all of their MiG-29s, which are these Russian jets, they wanted to give them to the United States to have in Ramstein Air Base in Germany. And then it would be up to the United States or someone else to actually get them into Ukraine. But the problem with that is that would make U.S. or, you know, if Ukrainians somehow got to that U.S. NATO air base in Germany, somebody still has to fly those jets into a contested airspace that would put them, you know, directly against Russian defense forces that are that basically have most of the Ukrainian airspace in their sights. And so the U.S. just said that this isn't, as you said, tenable. It's not feasible the way that it's laid out. They said, you know, if the Poles want to get those fighter jets to the Ukrainians, they absolutely can, you know, and they're working with the Poles to try to see if there's some way to do some sort of exchange. But just sending them to a U.S. and NATO base in Germany is just not the solution that's going to work. And as one more thing, as we saw today, when Secretary of State Blinken spoke, we've been noticing that the Ukrainians have been effectively using their air defense systems, you know, not necessarily relying on their aircraft. So that is what the U.S. and the U.K. and NATO want to focus on getting to the Ukrainians, more air defense systems that have been working in this war to date.
On that note, Carla, I wanted to ask you about that, because just a short while ago, U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken was standing alongside British Foreign Minister Liz Truss, and they were asked by reporters why the West was not implementing a no-fly zone over Ukraine, which is what Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky has been asking for. What can you tell us in terms of what the United States response and rationale is, and what more the United States plans to do to offer aid to Ukraine?
Well, they have spoken about the more than $300 million of assistance that is going into Ukraine, the majority of which has already gone to Ukrainians, to their defense forces already. But the United States is stopping short of talking specifics. I don't think they want the Russians to know specifically what the Ukrainians have. They don't want to detail exactly how much the Ukrainians have, because as a senior defense official explained, one, that's up to Ukraine to do. They want to say how much they have, you know, let them, but the U.S. can't come in and tell the rest of the world what the Ukrainian Air Force or what the Ukrainian military has specifically. So that's one of the caveats there. And another point is that with the no-fly zone, the problem with that for NATO and the United States is that they have stated that they're not going to fight Russians on Ukrainian soil in Ukrainian airspace. They're not going to do that. And in order to establish a no-fly zone, you basically have to be willing to shoot down a Russian aircraft if it refuses to abide by the no-fly zone. That is just what Secretary Blinken says is escalatory. And the U.S. is trying to tamp down this war and decrease the tensions. And so the U.S. is basically saying, we don't want to escalate. We want to decrease these tensions. And by establishing a no-fly zone, that would escalate things. However, on the flip side, you've got to look at what's happening on the ground. Civilians are dying. There was another hospital hit today in Mariupol. People are without electricity. They're without water. And when they try to escape from these humanitarian corridors, Russia is bombing them. So Ukrainians are looking at this clear-eyed, saying, okay, well, if you're not going to help us this way, how are you going to help? And so right now, all the U.S. and NATO are doing are shoring up their eastern flank and providing these defensive capabilities without actually stepping into the fight themselves, because their biggest worry is that a nuclear power as big as Russia would start targeting another nuclear power as big as NATO and the United States, and that would definitely expand this war outside of Ukraine.
Carla Babb is VOA's Pentagon correspondent. You're listening to VOA's Flashpoint Ukraine. I'm Steve Miller. U.S. lawmakers reached an agreement Tuesday night to send as much as $14 billion in humanitarian and military assistance to Ukraine. The bipartisan effort to confront Russia's unprovoked invasion of the independent Eastern European nation follows congressional support for U.S. President Joe Biden's announcement that he will ban Russian energy imports into the United States. VOA's congressional correspondent Catherine Gibson takes it from here.
Billions of dollars in humanitarian and military aid for Ukraine, well above the White House request, now close to being finalized by U.S. lawmakers after weeks of negotiations. A package that is likely just the beginning of U.S. assistance.
I think the world has to respond and help these refugees, and we're taking up a package that I think will just be the beginning, frankly. As my understanding is, it'll be a $12 billion package that will provide economic, military, and humanitarian support, but there will be more to come.
Ukraine's war effort got a boost Tuesday with the announcement Poland would send Ukraine MiG-29 fighter jets. But U.S. lawmakers are concerned bureaucratic delays are holding up other military assistance.
There is strong agreement to supply Ukraine with the defensive lethal weapons they need. And we've done that, and our allies have done that, countries have done that, and we've been pretty effective in getting that type of equipment to the Ukrainians. So I'm a little bit baffled as to why it's taking so long in regards to aircraft getting into Ukraine. President Zelensky's made it clear he needs it.
A top State Department official told lawmakers Putin's decision to invade has subjected his people to harsh sanctions, wiping out 30 years of progress in a matter of days.
As Putin tries to reduce Ukraine to rubble, he is also turning Russia into a prison. Credit cards and ATMs have stopped working. Capital controls are biting deeply. Imported food, technology, and other goods are drying up. And the last of Russia's free press has been strangled, all while the government hemorrhages money, money that belongs to the Russian people, to fund its war effort and to prop up the ruble.
And while the decision to ban Russian energy imports will have its own impact on Americans, U.S. lawmakers from both parties welcomed Biden's announcement.
Americans are willing to make sacrifices to support the kind of Ukrainian resistance, brave, fierce, bold defense of democracy that very much resonates with Americans because of our own history. But also important are steps we can take to reduce the spiral upward of gasoline prices.
But U.S. lawmakers also continue to emphasize that American support does not extend to direct military involvement.
I don't think any NATO country, certainly not ours, is prepared to directly engage with the Russians over Ukraine.
The U.S. Congress is expected to pass a government spending bill containing that aid money for Ukraine by the end of this week. Catherine Gibson, VOA News, Washington.
As Russia's war in Ukraine rages on, how does one frame discussions about the conflict after some have asked if this is the start of World War III or even the beginning of a second Cold War? Ralph Carter is a political science professor at Texas Christian University in Fort Worth, Texas, where he teaches courses in international relations and Russian foreign policy. I began our conversation by asking Professor Carter how current events are shaping his lectures in the classroom.
Well, I'm trying to intersperse news updates and answer students' questions about the war in Ukraine in amongst my regular scheduled subjects in my courses, because I have a responsibility to cover those too. So it's kind of a juggling act. One of the things that I've really been trying to do is make sense of all this, because I teach a Russian foreign policy course, and I'll be teaching that next year, and these events are going to be central to it.
So, you know,
Regarding that, I mean, this is one thing that I find very interesting is that as the war is taking place, there are still these avenues of diplomacy. The Biden administration says the diplomatic door continues to be open, wanting, you know, Putin to step back. You have the Israeli delegation, you know, trying to broker peace. You have talks in Belarus between Russians and Ukrainians. How are things supposed to work, and how do you observe them in terms of the status quo or the international norms, you know, being played out?
Well, President Putin has broken all the international norms with this invasion, and he is gambling that he can win his objective, which is to pacify Ukraine and put a pro-Russian leader there and recreate Ukraine is part of a traditional Russian sphere of influence. Now, it's always better, as Winston Churchill said, it's always better to talk than to fight. And so there is no downside to the Israeli efforts to broker some sort of discussions, to the border talks that are going on along the Ukrainian Belarusian border. But, you know, no bad outcomes necessarily from trying diplomacy by Secretary of State Blinken or President Biden himself. But President Putin has put himself in a corner, and he's made maximalist kind of demands. And I don't know that his leadership can survive in Russia if he backs down. It would make him look weak, and he's always traded on his strongman image ever since 1999. It also would be a sign that all those thousands of anti-war protesters in major Russian cities were right, that what the Russian people were being told about this war was a lie. And I just don't see any room for him to maneuver. I can't see the off-ramp for Putin at this point.
Professor Carter, I wanted to ask you, you know, you study this, international relations. How do you view the world's response to Russia's war on Ukraine?
I think it's absolutely amazing. It's the most startling thing I've seen in my career. President Putin has managed to do what no American president has ever managed to do, which is to totally unite NATO members around a common threat. Even during the Cold War, there were cracks and fissures within the NATO membership about how dangerous the Soviet Union really was. There isn't that now. And we're seeing countries do things that I would have never dreamed possible in reaction to the Russian aggression.
Professor Carter, what's your analysis of the United States and other NATO members saying that they'll go as far as to defend every inch of NATO territory, but not step into Ukraine?
Well, I think they're doing the most that they can do without starting World War III. And that's the key. When President Zelensky of Ukraine calls for the creation of a no-fly zone, that would mean NATO jets flying over Ukrainian airspace, shooting down Russian helicopters and Russian jets, and they're going to shoot back, and we've got the beginnings of World War III, which no one really wants. So President Biden did something that had two real benefits by adamantly saying we would defend every inch of NATO member soil, but we wouldn't send troops into Ukraine. He did two things there. One, he deterred President Putin from being more adventuristic by showing strong military resolve to defend all members of the NATO alliance, even the Baltic states that butt up against Russian borders and so on. But the second thing he did was he's denying President Putin of the argument that NATO is an existential threat to Russia, which he has been saying since, about 2007.
TCU political science professor Ralph Carter. And one final note, remember that on Monday, March 14th, Flashpoint Ukraine moves to its new time at 1935 UTC. And on that note, that's going to be it for us today. Be sure to stay up to date with continuing coverage on Ukraine and other world events at voanews.com and on our social media platforms. Just follow VOA News. On behalf of the entire Flashpoint Ukraine team, thanks for listening. Until next time, I'm VOA's Steve Miller. Be well, be safe, and good night.